A brief warning to our beloved listeners. In this episode, you will hear a frank discussion of sex, sexuality, both healthy and un, and in one particular case, a sex act. So if you have children in the car while you listen to this episode, you may be heading for a birds and bees conversation sooner than you might have hoped, or perhaps it's an opportunity to have a frank discussion of your own. In any case, I'm sure you're now dying to get to the rest of the conversation, so let's begin. Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes, and I'm here in historic Studio 44 with Barry Hardiman. Hi, Barry.
Hello, my friend.
Barry, do you hear that? For a couple of years now, you have only wanted one thing from me, and finally, this is the day I can give it to you. We are talking today about Outlander, which is about to start its third season on Stars.
You probably heard me squeal just now because that actually just hearing the background makes me do that.
For those of you who don't know, Outlander is a series based on the Diana Gabaldon novels about a woman who travels through time and finds an entirely new life. But we need just one more person, I think.
That's right. And that is why we went all the way to Boston to find our friend, Margaret Willison. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, you two.
Yay. It's so good to hear both of your voices. The basic setup is that Claire, who's played by Katrina Balf, is a nurse who served in World War II. But after that war, she time travels to 18th century Scotland right before one of the many Scottish uprisings against the British crown.
True story.
Separated from her husband, Claire eventually develops a new relationship with a hot man of the 18th century, one Jamie Fraser, played by Sam Heughan. And then she struggles with kind of how and whether to go back to her own time. Now, you're probably already thinking, so it's like a documentary. So Barry was the first person who introduced this show to me. Barry, were you in this show from the beginning?
Oh, I was in it. Because I was actually, I'm a books person.
Yeah. These books.
Right. Now, I will, just to cop to people who are really Outlander books people, I'm probably like five novels in. There was like a point at which I was like, oh my God, can these people just, like you do not want Jamie and Claire like interrupting your like particular uprising.
Right.
But in any case, so I was a books person before. I thought, how are you going to do this? Because as you can hear from the summary, it's so absurd.
Yeah. And very convoluted. Oh. And it gets more and more like there's multiple timelines and you're in 1945
yes.
and then 1740 something and eventually the 1960s. And
it is so absurd. But I really, really like the first book. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, I'm going to stick with this for the first book because I think it's a really great yarn. And that's why I was always at your desk.
Yeah.
You know,
I know,
like,
right?
Heaving.
Just ready.
Yes, exactly. With my breast heaving like a.
Dreaming like of Celts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Dinnefesh.
So what's your, Margaret, are you an Outlander books person or no?
So I have read the first book, but nothing beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing that struck me is that I read the first book to prepare for the series because I'd heard about it. I was curious. It looked like something I would like. And Outlander is a book that like smarty pants women who have a lot of free tote bags from library conferences really tend to enjoy.
We love you too.
My people.
Yeah.
Our people.
Our people.
Yep.
I think. Yeah. So I read the novel in advance and then I watched the show and I actually like the show a little bit better because when you're not embedded in the main character's thoughts, when you're not embedded in Claire's perspective, she actually has to take more concrete actions to demonstrate that she's sort of like a woman of the modern world.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say that I never get aggravated with her. For constantly putting herself at risk for being burned as a witch.
Yeah.
But
yes. That's just one of her problems.
It gives a good balance because otherwise the story can be very like, my husband is the handsomest man in the entire world.
Yes.
Have I told you about my husband?
Yes. Yeah. This is one of the things that I find so funny about it is that this show for me, and I've not read the books, but this show for me works on one level, like there are things about it that are really well thought out that I think we should talk about. One of which is, and there's some good writing about this that I can link to on the blog, but this show's treatment of sex, particularly between Claire and Jamie and their developing relationship, is much more thoughtful and interesting than I think a lot of cable dramas in their treatment of a couple's sex life.
Oh, yeah.
Vastly. I mean, there were just tomes written about this in the wedding episode in season one.
Which is almost unwatchable. It's so sexy.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost like, oh, no, I burned a hole in the house.
It's true.
Like, it's like you turn into a laptop.
Yeah. No, it's true.
Yeah.
And it was just like, finally, this was one of the first times that we were ever really seeing, like, a a long, in-depth sex scene filmed for the female gaze rather than the male gaze, or at least equally pleasurable to both.
Yeah.
And also, you know, remember there is also, I mean, there was a sort of mission statement at the beginning, which is oral sex performed by a man on a woman in the first episode.
Right.
Which was like, here's how we're going to do this, guys.
Yeah.
Like, welcome.
Right.
Yeah.
Although what you're talking about in the wedding episode, which is the first sex scene you get between Claire and Jamie, although it's very sexy, the episode is very sexy.
Oh, yeah.
The first, like, sexual encounter that they have is not a big deal.
No.
And partly it's because she's experienced and he is not, which is definitely a reversal of not only usual television sex scenes, but historical romances in particular.
Yeah.
You have so many that involve the dashing, muscular man sort of deflowering the young virgin. And in this situation, you sort of have the reverse.
She totally deflowers him. Yeah.
And I mean, to the degree that that's even a thing.
Right.
But then as it goes on, and the sex that they're having at different times is different based on some of it is sort of bonding and healing, and some of it is kind of restorative, and some of it is just hot.
And some of it is like complicated by the plot in which both of them do some really dumb things.
Right.
And sometimes that can get kind of maddening, too.
And they also do a very good job of showing them with many different kinds of partners.
Yeah.
And showing that they continue to have sexual lives even independent of this, you know, like one true soul love that they have with each other. Which I think is especially fascinating for a female character.
Yeah.
Because like it's so rare that you're allowed to see a female character with an active sexual appetite at all unless that is the only characteristic that she has. And then to have one where she has an active sexual appetite, she has one absolute all-consuming true love, but also has sex with other men of varying different types is pretty unique.
Yeah,
but not to the world. to the world, it's pretty ordinary.
But to television, it's surprising how rarely you see that. And I think her relationship with Frank, the husband that she left in 1945, the thing that I think is interesting about Frank is I actually said to our producer today, is there such a thing as Team Frank, right? Because Frank is, like, it's not his fault. She vanishes.
Yeah.
But to me, one of the things that makes the fantasy of Outlander so compelling is that it is really this fantasy of even if you like the life you have, fantasizing about all the lives you didn't have and could have had. And obviously, even in the absence of time travel, I think a lot of people have had that moment where even if you're content, you have these ideas about it could have gone another way.
Yeah,
I could have done something else.
And sometimes they're just fantasies, and that's okay, too. And this is this thing where you're sort of really playing that out because, you know, anybody who's ever held a romance novel has seen Jamie on the cover, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes on the back, too.
Right.
But
I mean, the best thing is you see him on the cover and he's got, like, the shirt with the lace ties on. Right. And then you flip the cover open partly and he has no shirt but still a kilt.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's always a kilt. It's amazing.
It's true.
Although I do think, while we're on the subject of sex, I think we do have to note the depiction of sexual violence.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is the thing that I think is, I will be interested to see what you ladies think, because so partly when I went through these books, I thought, well, this is some lazy writing. This is some rape and set instead of plot, you know, not especially after the first book. You know, once you get to Paris and it's like, oh, really?
Yeah.
We had to rape a couple more people and these
dresses
like that kind of was a thing. And yet I think, I mean, particularly, and I know this has been written about, but I think it's important to note that there is every rape victim in this is treated like a real victim of trauma, especially the man, which you never see. I can't think of another. Can you think of another pop culture?
Not, I mean, in Oz, there were prison rapes, but which I haven't seen. But I think that for me, this was a very unusual depiction of sexual violence. That storyline, the one that is where the victim is a man, was to me the most interesting and well thought out of
truly intelligent
of the places that they've gone with stories about sexual violence.
Yeah.
I do think a lot of the rest of the time, mm-hmm. and it does kind of pop up over and over again, I think that it does then fall into some things that feel more tropey.
Yeah.
They feel more like it's there to heighten stakes. And not only is there quite a bit of actual rape in this show, mm-hmm. there's also a lot of kind of the constant threat of rape.
Yes.
And I understand that that's realistic to the worlds in which many women live mm-hmm. and have
lived.
The past
was pretty
many
rapey.
Women and men live and have lived.
Sure.
However, in a show like this, you have to be really careful that it isn't, as you said, mm-hmm. instead of plot.
Right.
I completely agree. I wish there was less rape, just in general.
Yeah.
But I feel like when it chooses to take it on, it does it more responsibly than a mm-hmm. lot of shows do.
Yeah.
It does it with a wider array of victims and a wider array of sincere emotional processing coming after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
It's doing it in slightly different contexts. But, yeah, I think they go to that well a little more often than they need to for plot, especially, I think, in the second season.
Oh, as the second season wears on. And I think this kind of brings me to one of the other things that I wanted to talk about, which mm-hmm. is, so for me, I binged this show in giant gulps. And so same. I kind of had a very concentrated dose of it, which is not how most people have experienced mm-hmm. it. But for me, the first few episodes took a while to kind of get going. And then the second half of the first season, which mm-hmm. is the second 8-episode chunk in the first mm-hmm. season, was the part that to me was the most interesting. Mm-hmm. Then when you get to the second season, so the first season all takes place in Scotland and you're kind of getting to know everybody. In the second season, all of a sudden you're in France with a bunch of French aristocrats and all of a sudden it's all about the war mm-hmm. because, as we said, this all has to do with this battle for the British throne and this Scottish uprising taking place in Scotland anyway. And I think once it's about the war,
oy.
I am not a war show person. I get bored. I start fast running a little bit because I just battlefield stuff where, you know, everything is just eventually just
mud.
Swords squishing
mud blood.
Into people, mm-hmm. mud, blood.
It's all squishy.
It's not that interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the things that I find most compelling about this show are in the personal relationships. Mm-hmm. And it does have mm-hmm. a tendency to separate Claire and Jamie for stretches of time.
Oh, boy, yeah.
And every time that happens, I'm always like, oh, boy. It's like when half of The Office went to Stamford.
It does feel like that, yeah.
We got to get Jim back in the office. That's how I feel whenever somebody goes tromping off into the woods or into another time.
I feel, I know, it's funny that you say, so I am a war series person.
Well, right, you read Game of Thrones, and I don't.
Yeah, read, watch, I got them the whole shebang. But I will say this one, and I feel the same way about the books that I do. This particular war story is so frustrating because they go from, and I think I'm not, since it's going to go both ways, they go from one particular strategy to another completely different strategy, which is such a, and like, you know, it's because Claire presents as such a very, very intelligent
she
woman.
Does.
She's educated. She's so, it's like, Claire, did you not think this through, Sesnick? Did you not? Because
oh,
I
so
just,
glad.
Like, I cannot ever.
Someone did do a bad Scottish accent.
Oh, I cannot
That's
help it.
That's the one thing we really needed Glenn here for.
Yeah, I know. I miss him. I do. That was for you, Glenn.
Yeah,
but
true.
That's the thing, is that it, like, as far as the plot goes, you could totally skip France.
Mm-hmm.
You could totally skip it.
There's a problem. So war stories I don't love, but I can handle. I love time travel stories, but the problem is you cannot simultaneously do a Back to the Future. I have to make sure, like, my parents marry one another mm-hmm. so that I don't vanish in the future, and a Let's Kill Hitler plot.
Yes.
You have to pick a lane.
Right.
You get to do one of those. You can either change everything about history by changing a massive watershed moment mm-hmm. and be like, well, I guess future generations are just, they're fending for themselves. Like,
right.
Good luck, folks.
Yeah, and I think one of the flaws in the presentation of this show, and again, we're talking here about the deeper stuff.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues is they haven't really come up with what kind of time travel show they are.
Yes.
And we laid out on this show one time a kind of a taxonomy of kinds of time travel.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a story where you know, it's one timeline, and when you change it, everything in the future disappears. Mm-hmm. Are you one where you can't change anything that will cause anything in the future to change? Mm-hmm. Are you one where you create multiple timelines? I don't think they've completely committed to how time travel works mm-hmm. in this world. Now, with all of this said, I don't think this show is mostly operating on those kind of levels. Mm-hmm. I think this show is mostly operating as an incredibly pleasurable, swoony mm-hmm. period story. And on that level, I enjoy it a great deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a period piece, it's incredible. And one of the things that I wanted to mention in terms of like the beauty of the aesthetics of it mm. is that you have the on-screen love story between Claire and Jamie, but then there's kind of a covert love story in the actual aesthetics of the show mm-hmm. because Ronald Moore, the show director, is married to Terry Dreschbach. I'm going to say her last name is.
Okay.
The costume designer. And so there's kind of like a secondary love story in how beautifully designed everything is and
wow,
how beautifully
I didn't know
shot yeah. and used. There's an incredible profile of the two of them in the New York Times from 2015 that I encourage everyone listening to look up. You get like both, like I say, a textual love story mm-hmm. and then a subtextual love story
yeah.
with how beautifully the garments are photographed and used. And how much of a story they tell.
You could imagine. I love that. You could really imagine that he would be like, you know, we could skip France. And she'd be like, because I got a brown and mustard number for when she sees Black Jack again that's going to knock your socks off.
Yeah, I got
to
do some.
There is this dress with nipple piercings I need to feature.
Exactly.
That is a remarkable dress. Yeah. That is one of those dresses where I was like, I assume that it's a real kind of dress.
Yeah.
And I just don't know the story of like what kind of women would wear that kind of dress versus wouldn't. And I was very intrigued by it and did not know how to Google it.
Yeah. Well, certainly not at work.
Yeah.
There are great interviews with her about that dress and about how they came up with the designs for it. And I'd say in that part of season two and in the couple episodes of season three we've seen so far, mm-hmm. they do one thing that's not great, which is they hit the tone they've decided on for not Scotland like a little harder than I'd like them to.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
in France,
especially
it's like,
in the hair versions,
everybody was sexy in France.
Yeah,
that's really
people
true.
Got bikini waxes.
But, yeah, they sure
but here's,
did.
But
a thing
here's
I
the
learned.
Thing. I like I said, when it's operating on that level of kind of, I don't even want to say shallow pleasures, but like aesthetic pleasures and tonal pleasures, I think it works incredibly well a lot of the time. I really, really like the central two performances.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think the actor, Tobias Menzies, I think it is.
He's wonderful.
Great.
Who plays both plays
Pankless roles.
Frank, right? Who is exactly two right. terrible roles. One is Claire's husband, Frank, who she leaves in 1945, and the other is Frank's ancestor, who is this terrible, monstrous villain that Claire and Jamie are battling back in the 1700s. I think it's very weird to think about how the double casting works in this
mm-hmm.
case, because Frank is not really a villain.
Mm-mm.
And I'm kind of surprised that it seems like a good idea to use the same actor.
Because wouldn't she, every time she looked at him, just be instantly traumatized?
Exactly.
I mean, there's no way. So I agree with you. I think that was sort of a mistake. But I also will say.
But he's great.
He's doing so much with this completely thankless role in which, you know, he not only gets saddled with the actual problem of his wife having an affair with an 18th century,
mm-hmm.
I can't even say what he is. He's he's very nice looking. Also a wonderful actor, a very wonderful actor.
I really like this.
I really just want to, I want to stop talking about his pecs for 1 minute
right.
and say he does some really amazing work.
He really does.
So Frank, who has this terrible situation, they then saddle him with, like, he's always the person who's pushing against the changes of the world.
Yes. He's got a rough go with that character because mm-hmm. there's not a lot to him other than being the wrong guy and the monster.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, he's doing, as an actor, just incredible, incredible work to make those characters interesting, but the writing is not there to support him.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
Right.
I think
and it's such a shame. I really do. I find Frank very sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And although obviously I don't find Captain Blackjack Randall sympathetic,
mm-mm.
his performance, like, he embodies him with, like, depth and nuance
and weirdness
and weirdness.
Like,
weirdness.
He is like the monstrousness of him is there's this strain of weirditude is just that I think is clearly a choice that this actor is making, and it makes him beyond just a monster.
Yeah,
right. The writing keeps bringing him back to that very simple monster place,
uh-huh.
and you're
mm-hmm.
like, could he be in a room with a child for like 3 minutes with not physically attacking the child. Like, just maybe.
Yeah.
I think that's
right. Perhaps.
I think that's fair. But I think he is a monster. I mean, I think that's his role to play in this particular story. And he's really rarely not one for more than 30 seconds at a time.
Right.
But,
that's true.
But I do want to say, like, I think, you know, it's a show that really encourages you to look at how beautiful both of these lead characters are, right? Mm-hmm. She's this incredibly gorgeous, pale, dark-haired, kind of perfect lass,
but
right?
But with age, she is not your...
Yeah.
I will say she looks her age in a way that as... I mean, I hope that I look her age just like that someday as well. But
sure.
I, you know, but she is...
just like an artful gray streak.
Totally. An artful gray streak. And also just she's like got the best crow's feet.
Yeah.
I just like I tried to paint them on the other day. Anyway, don't do it. But the point is like they really do show that she is older than Jamie.
Yeah.
And they're not... So which is another one of those sort of subversive gender things. And then he, of course, is just...
You know, it would be so easy if you are attracted to men. I think it is hard not to watch this show and understand that at some level, this is just as close as you can get to like the cultural idea of what an attractive man is.
Yeah, right.
He has a gorgeous face. He has this little cleft in his chin. He's got a gigantic,
like,
muscly bod.
I mean, it's ridiculous, actually. It reminds me of, I will never forget being in the theater when the trailer for When Stella Got Her Groove Back came on, and Taye Diggs sort of emerges from the ocean, and the entire audience just, like, fell into itself and breathed, you know, and I instantly got the giggles because that's my reaction. And every time I see Jamie, it's somewhere between ha and pfft.
Yeah. It feels unreal. It's the same thing happens at a couple of key moments in Girls Trip. If you haven't seen Girls Trip, there are a couple of extraordinarily good-looking men in Girls Trip who had the same effect on that audience. It is interesting, as you said, there's a lot of female gaze where you would normally get, you know, male gaze. Mm-hmm. But we could go on about this for quite a long time.
Like, and just that.
I know. Just this part. We've tried not to spend the entire time talking about pecs, but tell us what you think about Outlander. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. When we come back, it's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour comes from Sunbasket. Sunbasket sends organic and sustainable ingredients to your door, pre-measured and ready to go, so you can prepare delicious meals in around 30 minutes. Sunbasket takes the guesswork out of preparation, makes cleanup easier, and you get to skip the grocery store. With meals designed to fit every busy lifestyle, choose from paleo, lean and clean, gluten-free, vegetarian, and family options. Get $35 off your first order at sunbasket.com/happyhour.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Juice Beauty, whose founder Karen Benke believes that women shouldn't have to choose between their beauty and their health. Juice Beauty is radically transforming the chemistry of beauty with luxurious, high-performance skincare and vibrant plant pigment makeup, formulated with antioxidant-rich certified organic ingredients. Every organic drop feeds your skin. Find your clean skincare or makeup solution by signing up for emails on juicebeauty.com/happyhour and enjoy a special offer with your first order.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week. Margaret H. Hula Hoop Willison, what is making you happy this week?
I have two things. One is delayed gratification and one is instant gratification.
Ooh.
And I didn't feel good offering the first without also providing the second. So delayed gratification. I am reading a great romance novel that I need everyone to go out and pre-order so that in February, you will get a gift from your past self. And it is The Wedding Date by Jasmine Guillory. And all I can tell you is it is a remarkable book with huge chemistry between the two leads, who are both smart, believable human beings who have jobs and friends that matter and have weight in the plot. It's a biracial romance, a black female lead, and a white man, and it is so good, and I can't wait to talk about it with everybody in February.
And we should say you are pals with Jasmine, right?
I am pals with Jasmine,
okay.
Yes.
Sold.
And then, while you're waiting, you should watch the movie For a Good Time Call, available streaming on Netflix currently. It's a couple of years old, but it stars Ari Grainer, who's one of the most underrated comic actresses of Hollywood history, maybe, as one half of a pair of college frenemies who are forced to move in together end up opening a phone sex line and also becoming best friends. And it is a frothy, perfect, gently subversive romantic comedy with really fantastic costumes and extremely good jokes.
Ooh. Sounds very good, Margaret Wilson. Thank you very much. Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I have one, and it is between instant and delayed, which is that I don't know how everyone else on this particular pajama party feels about this show, but I cannot tell you how excited I am that Broad City is coming back next week. And I did a monster binge watch with my husband yesterday. It is such a delight, and for some reason it really appeals to me right now. For me, it's the girls I always wanted.
Okay.
In that it is the two leads, Abby Jacobson and Alana Glazer, are both such delights and in different ways. And what I love is this particular comedy, which is just really, really ridiculous and sometimes filthy. And, you know, truly like giggle. I mean, there are times where I've really gotten the giggles in the way that I need to pause it to recover.
Uh-huh.
There's a real optimism to the show that I really need in my life.
Yeah.
And I love that the show, no matter where it goes and how, you know, whatever scrapes these two gals get up to, still preserves a sense of confidence and optimism that I just adore, and I cannot wait for more of them. So that premieres, I believe, September 13th, which is the day before my birthday. Thanks, Comedy Central.
Very nice. Thank you very much, Barry Hardiman. I have been killing some time watching ER, which is now on Pop, a network that you might have, that you might not know you have. ER reruns run on Pop. They've been sort of intermittently available and not available, which means I really have not watched very much ER since I was first watching it.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to come into the run on Pop at the one where George Clooney as Doug Ross rescues a kid from a culvert where he's like stuck in a thing and he's right. drowning. And it was basically the George Clooney star-making moment where it kind of went from likely to inevitable that he was going to be a gigantic star. There are these hero shots of him in a tux rescuing a drowning
the
kid.
Gilding the lily.
And it really does feel like it's gilding the lily. But on this watch, I noticed, you know, how interesting some of the camera work is. And on rewatching this show, I've really come to appreciate that although current prestige television, quote unquote, cable and stuff, have certainly done a lot of interesting and great things, I think it can be easy to forget that television was already kind of getting good by the time that all started. And part of that was happening on networks. And ER is kind of one of those where because it dragged on for so long and kind of lost its oomph in the last three or four seasons, I think sometimes people don't talk enough about how really strong the first several seasons of that show are and how heartbreaking it could be when things didn't go well for them as doctors. I've been really enjoying it. So ER reruns on the Pop Network.
Oh, I'm so Absolutely. Excited for more Dr. Ross.
It's all very exciting. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Barry at B Hardiman. That's H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N. You can follow Margaret at Mrs. Friday Next. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thank you, Margaret, for being with us from Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Barry, for being here in the studio with me as always.
Thank you both.
I'm heading off to the Toronto International Film Festival for a week. While I'm gone, the team has some great stuff in store. And if you think of it in the meantime, go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a nice review. It helps people find the show. And we will see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. When you're in the mood for some fun, check out the Ask Me Another podcast for games, trivia, and puzzles. Try your brain at poetry based on Star Trek, play Two Truths and a Lie, and test your knowledge of 90s comedy with guests Janine Garofalo and Lily Taylor. Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. Play along now on the NPR One app or wherever you find your podcasts.